Let's go! Overboard! Leto yelled. He grabbed his friend's arm and pushed him out of the cabin. From the forward compartment, Leto tossed hoses and portable pumps into the frothing water. Dip this end of the hose into the deepest water you can reach, and try not to cut yourself on the reef. Romber scrambled over the rail while Leto followed, trying to maintain his balance in the churning tide pools and rough surf. The boat was snagged, so for the moment they needn't worry about drowning. Just discomfort. The pump started, and seawater sprayed out of two hoses, one held by each boy. The water fell in a thick curtain onto the flames. Romber swiped blood out of his eyes and kept directing his hose. They doused the coracle with endless torrents until finally, slowly, the flames began to die back. Romber looked bedraggled and miserable, but Leto felt oddly exhilarated. "Perk up, Romber. Think about it. On Ix we had to escape from a revolution that nearly destroyed the whole planet. Makes this little mishap seem like child's play, wouldn't you say?"
Right, the other said glumly. "Most fun I've had in ages."
The two of them sat waist-deep in the surging water, playing their hoses over the fire. Smoke continued to rise into the clear Caladan sky like a distress beacon. Soon they heard the distant but increasing roar of powerful engines, and moments later a high-speed wingboat came into view, a double-hulled craft capable of reaching tremendous speeds over the water. It drew near and swung clear of the rocks. On the foredeck stood Thufir Hawat, shaking his head at Leto in disapproval. Among the responsibilities of command is the necessity to punish, but only when the victim demands it. Prince Raphael Corino, Discourses on Leadership in a Galactic Imperium, 12th edition. Her chocolate hair in disarray, her clothes torn and inappropriate for the desert, the woman ran across the sands, seeking escape. Janice Milam looked up over her shoulder, blinking sun-scalded tears from her eyes. Seeing the shadow of the suspensor platform that held Baron Harkonnen and his nephew Rabban, she put on a burst of speed. Her feet dug into the powder sand, making her lose her balance. She staggered toward the open wasteland, where it was hotter, drier, deadlier. Buried in the lee of a nearby dune, the thumper throbbed, pulsing, calling. She tried to find a refuge of rocks, cool caves, even the shadow of a boulder. At the very least, she wanted to die out of sight, so they wouldn't be able to laugh at her. But the Harkonnens had dropped her into a sea of open dunes. Janice slipped and tasted dust. From their safe vantage on the suspensor platform, the Baron and his nephew watched her struggles, the pitiful flight of a tiny human figure on the sand. The observers wore still suits like costumes. Their masks hung loose. They had returned to Arrakis from Gedi Prime only a few weeks before, and Janice had arrived on the previous day's prison ship. At first the Baron had thought to execute the treacherous woman back at Barony, but Rabban had wanted her to suffer in front of his eyes out on the scorching sands, in punishment for helping Duncan Idaho escape. "She seems so insignificant down there, doesn't she?" the Baron commented, without interest. Sometimes his nephew did have unique ideas, though he lacked the focus to carry them through. "This is much more satisfying than a simple beheading, and beneficial to the worms. Food for them." Rabban made a low sound in his thick throat, remarkably like an animal's growl. "It shouldn't be long now. Those thumpers always call a worm. Always." The Baron stood tall on the platform, feeling the hot sun, the glistening sweat on his skin. His body ached, a condition he'd been experiencing for several months now. He nudged the suspensor platform forward so they could get a better view of their victim. He mused. "That boy is an Atreides now, from what I hear, working with the Duke's Seleucid bulls.
He's dead if I ever see him again. Rabban wiped salty sweat from his sunburned forehead. Him and any other Atreides I catch alone. You're like an ox, Rabban. The Baron gripped his nephew's strong shoulder. But don't waste energy on insignificant things. House Atreides is our real enemy, not some insignificant stable boy. Stable boy. Below, Janice skidded on her face down the slope of a dune and scrambled to her feet again. With a basso laugh, the Baron said, "She'll never get far enough away from the thumper in time." The resonant vibrations continued to throb into the ground like the distant drum beat of a death song. "It's too hot out here," Rabban grumbled. "Couldn't you have brought a canopy?" Pulling his still suit's water tube to his mouth, he drew in an unsatisfying sip of warm water. "I like to sweat. It's good for the health, purges poisons from the system." Rabban fidgeted. When he tired of watching the woman's clumsy run, he looked across the seared landscape, searching for the tracks of an oncoming behemoth. "By the way, whatever happened to that planetologist the Emperor foisted on us? I took him worm-hunting once." "Kynes? Who knows?" the Baron snorted. "He's always out in the desert, comes into Carthag to deliver reports whenever he feels like it, then disappears again. Haven't heard from him in a while." "What happens if he gets hurt? Could we get in trouble for not keeping a better eye on him?" "I doubt it. Elrood's mind isn't what it used to be." The Baron laughed, a thin, nasal tone of derision. "Not that the Emperor's mind was much even in its prime." The dark-haired woman, coated now with clinging dust, fought her way across the dunes. She kicked up sand, falling and struggling back onto her feet, refusing to give up. "This bores me," Rabban said. "No challenge just to stand here and watch." "Some punishments are easy," the Baron observed, "but easy isn't always sufficient. Erasing this woman does nothing to erase the black mark she made on the honor of House Harkonnen, with the help of House Atreides." "Then let's do more," Rabban said with a thick-lipped grin, "to the Atreides." The Baron felt the heat shimmering on his exposed face, absorbed the thrumming silence of the baked desert. When he smiled, the skin on his cheeks threatened to crack. "Maybe we will." "What, Uncle?" "Perhaps it's time to get rid of the old Duke. No more thorns in our side." Rabban bubbled with anticipation. With a calmness designed to agitate his nephew, the Baron focused the oil lenses of his binoculars and scanned the distance at varying magnifications. He hoped to spot the worm sign himself rather than relying on the security ornithopters. Finally, he sensed the tremors approaching. He felt his pulse synchronize with the thumper. Lump, lump, lump. Crescent dune tracks spread shadow ripples toward the horizon. An elongated mound in motion. A cresting of sand like a big fish swimming just under the surface. In the still hot air, the Baron heard the rasping, abrasive sound of the slithering beast. Excitedly, he grabbed Rabban's elbow and pointed. The comm unit at Rabban's ear chirped, and a filtered voice spoke so loudly that the Baron could hear the muffled words. Rabban swatted at the device. "We know, we see it." The Baron continued his musings as the buried worm approached like a locomotive. "I've kept up my contacts with individuals on Caladan, you know. The old Duke is a creature of habit, and habits can be dangerous." He smiled, his lips hard, his eyes squinting against the glare. "We've already put operatives in place, and I have a plan." Far out in the dunes ahead of them, Janice spun around and ran in blind panic. She had seen the oncoming worm. The rippling upheaval of sand reached the thumper in the lee of a whaleback dune. In an explosion like a tidal wave engulfing a dock, the thumper vanished into an immense mouth lined with crystal teeth. "Move the platform," the Baron urged. "Follow her." Rabban worked the suspensor controls, floating them up over the desert for a better view of the action. Following the vibrations of the woman's footsteps, the worm changed course. The sand rippled again as the behemoth dived underground and prowled like a shark searching for new prey. Janice collapsed on the top of a dune, shuddering, holding her knees up against her chin, as she tried not to make any sound that might attract the great worm. Sand skittered around her. She froze, held her breath. The monster paused. Janice huddled in terror, praying silently. Rabban brought the suspensor platform above the trapped woman. Janice glared up at the Harkonnens, her jaw clenched, her eyes like daggers, a cornered animal afraid to move. Baron Harkonnen reached down to grab an empty bottle of spice liquor, drained during their long hot wait for her execution. He raised the brown glass bottle as if in a toast, grinning. The sandworm waited underground, alert for even a fractional movement. The Baron tossed the bottle at the dusky-skinned woman. The glass tumbled in the air, reflecting glints of sunlight end over end. It struck the sand within meters of Janice's feet with a loud thunk. The worm lunged into motion, toward her. Screaming curses at the Harkonnens, Janice plunged down the hillside, followed by a small avalanche of sand. But the ground dropped out from beneath her, like a gaping trap door. The mouth of the worm rose up, a cavern of glittering teeth in the sunlight to swallow Janice and everything around her. A puff of dust drifted on the wavering air as the huge worm sank back under the sands, like a whale beneath the sea. Rabban touched his comm unit, demanding to know whether the spotting craft overhead had taken high-resolution hollows. "I didn't even see her blood. Didn't hear her scream." He sounded disappointed. "You may strangle one of my servants," the Baron offered, "if it will make you feel better. But only because I'm in such a good mood." From the suspensor platform, he gazed down at the placid dunes, knowing the danger and death that lurked beneath them. He wished his old rival Duke Paulus Atreides had been down there instead of the woman. For that, he would have had every Harkonnen hollow recorder in operation, so that he could enjoy it from every angle and savor the experience over and over, each time tasting the morsel of human flesh as the worm did. "No matter," the Baron told himself. "I have something just as interesting in mind for the old man." Speak the truth. That is always much easier, and is often the most powerful argument. Bene Gesserit Axiom. Duncan Idaho stared at the monstrous Seleucid bull through the force field bars of its cage, his child's gaze meeting the multifaceted eyes of the ferocious creature. The bull had a scaly black hide, multiple horns, and two brains that were capable of only one thought: destroy anything that moves. The boy had worked in the stables for weeks now, doing his best at even the most miserable of jobs, feeding and watering the combat bulls, tending them, cleaning their filthy cages, while the beasts were pushed back behind force barricades to keep them from attacking him. He enjoyed his job, despite what others considered the degrading meniality of the tasks to be performed. Duncan didn't even think of it as low-level work, though he knew several other stable boys did. These were simply chores to him, and he considered his payment in freedom and happiness more than sufficient. Because of the gracious generosity of his benefactor, Duke Paulus Atreides, he loved the old man dearly. Duncan ate well now and had a warm place to live and fresh clothes whenever he needed them. Though no one asked him to, he worked hard anyway, driven and dedicated. There was even some time for relaxation, and he and the other workers had their own gymnasium and recreation hall. He could also go splashing in the sea whenever he wished, and a friendly man from the dockside occasionally took him along for a day's fishing. At present, the old Duke kept five of the mutated bulls for his games. Duncan had sought to befriend the beasts, trying to tame them with bribes of sweet green grass or fresh fruits. But an exasperated stablemaster, Iresk, had caught him at it.
"The old Duke uses them in his bullfights. Do you think he prefers them tame?"
His puffy eyes had widened with anger. The white-haired stablemaster had accepted him on the Duke's orders, but grudgingly, and he gave Duncan no special treatment.
"He wants them to attack. He doesn't want the creatures to purr when he's on display in the Plaza de Toros. What would the people think?"
Duncan had lowered his eyes and backed off. Always obedient, he never again tried to make these beasts his pets. He had seen holo recordings of the Duke's previous spectacles, as well as the performances of other renowned matadors. While he was saddened to witness the slaughter of one of his magnificent charges, he was amazed at the bravery and self-assurance of Duke Atreides. The last corrida on Caladan had been staged to celebrate the departure of Leto Atreides for his off-planet schooling. Now, after many months, there would be another, as the old Duke had recently announced a new grand bullfight, this one to entertain his guests from Ix, who had come to stay as exiles on Caladan. Exiles. In a sense, Duncan was one too. Though he had his own sleeping quarters in a communal outbuilding, where many of the castle workers lived, sometimes Duncan bedded down in the stables, where he could hear the snorting and simmering beasts. He had put up with far worse conditions in his life. The stables themselves were comfortable, and he enjoyed being alone with the animals. Whenever he slept out there, he listened to the movements of the bulls in his dreams. He felt himself becoming attuned to their moods and instincts. For days now, though, the creatures had grown increasingly fretful and moody, prone to rampages in their pens, as if they knew their nemesis, the old Duke, was planning another bullfight. Standing outside the cages, young Duncan noticed fresh, deep score marks where the Seleucid bulls had rammed their enclosures in an attempt to break free, trying to gore imaginary opponents. This was not right. Duncan knew it. He'd spent so much time watching the bulls that he felt he understood their instincts. He knew how they should react, knew how to provoke them and how to calm them. But this behavior was out of the ordinary. When he mentioned it to Stablemaster Iresk, the gaunt man looked suddenly alarmed. He scratched the shock of thinning white hair on his head, but then his expression changed. He fixed his suspicious, puffy eyes on Duncan.
"Say, there's nothing wrong with those bulls. If I didn't know you better, I'd think you were just another Harkonnen trying to cause trouble. Now run along."
"Harkonnens? I hate them."
"You lived among them, stable rat. We Atreides are trained to be constantly on the alert."
He gave Duncan a nudge.
"Don't you have chores to complete? Or do I need to find some more?"
He'd heard that Iresk had actually come from Rachis many years before, so he was not truly an Atreides. Still, Duncan didn't contradict the man, though he refused to back down.
"I was their slave. They tried to hunt me down like an animal."
Iresk lowered his bushy eyebrows. With his lanky build and wild, pale hair, he looked like a scarecrow.
"Even among the common people, the old feud between houses runs deep. How do I know what you might have up your sleeve?"
"That's not why I told you about the bulls, sir," Duncan said. "I'm just worried. I don't know anything about house feuds."
Iresk laughed, not taking him seriously.
"The Atreides Harkonnen breach goes back thousands of years. Don't you know anything about the Battle of Corrin, the Great Betrayal, the Bridge of Hrethgir? How a cowardly Harkonnen ancestor almost cost the humans our victory against the hated machine minds. Corrin was our last stand, and we would have fallen to the final onslaught if an Atreides hadn't saved the day."
"I never learned much history," Duncan said. "It was hard enough just finding food to eat." Behind folds of wrinkled skin, the stablemaster's eyes were large and expressive, as if he were trying to appear to be a kindly old man. Well, House Atreides and House Harkonnen were allies once. Friends, even. But never again after that treachery. The feud has burned hot ever since. And you, boy, came from Gedi Prime. From the Harkonnen homeworld.
Iresk shrugged his bony shoulders.
You don't expect us to trust you completely, do you? Be thankful the old Duke trusts you as much as he does.
But I had nothing to do with the Battle of Corrin, Duncan said, still not understanding.
What does that have to do with the bulls? That was a long time ago.
And that's about all the jabber I have time for this afternoon.
Iresk removed a long-handled manure scraper from a prong on the wall.
You just keep your suspicions to yourself from now on. Everyone here knows what he's supposed to do.
Though Duncan worked hard and did everything he could to earn his keep, the fact that he had come from the Harkonnens continued to cause him grief. Some of the others working in the stables, not just Iresk, treated him as a barely concealed spy, though what Rabban would have wanted with a 9-year-old infiltrator, Duncan couldn't guess. Not until now, however, had he felt so affronted by the prejudice.
"There's something wrong with the bull, sir," he insisted. "The Duke needs to know about it before his bullfight."
Iresk laughed at him again. "When I need the advice of a child in my business, I'll be sure to ask, young Idaho." The stablemaster left, and Duncan returned to the stalls to stare at the agitated, ferocious Seleucid bulls. They glared back at him with burning, faceted eyes. Something was terribly wrong. He knew it, but no one would listen to him.
Imperfections, if viewed in the proper light, can be extremely valuable. The great schools, with their incessant questing for perfection, often find this postulate difficult to understand, until it is proven to them that nothing in the universe is random. From The Philosophies of Old Terra, one of the recovered manuscripts. In the darkness of her isolated and protected bedroom in the mother school complex, Mohiam sat straight up, holding her swollen belly. Her skin felt tight and leathery, without the resilience of youth. Her bedclothes were drenched in perspiration, and the nightmare remained fresh in her mind. The back of her skull pounded with visions of blood and flames. It had been an omen, a message, a screaming premonition that no Bene Gesserit could ignore. She wondered how much melange her nurse had given her, and if it might have interacted with some other medication they'd administered. She could still taste the bitter gingery cinnamon flavor inside her mouth. How much spice was it safe for a pregnant woman to take? Mohiam shuddered. No matter how she tried to rationalize her terror, she could not ignore the power of the sending. Dreams, nightmares, prescience, foretelling terrible events that would shake the Imperium for millennia, a future that must never come to pass. She dared not ignore the warning. But could she trust herself to interpret it correctly? Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam was but a tiny pebble at the beginning of an avalanche. Did the sisterhood really know what it was doing? And what about the baby growing inside her, still a month from term? The vision's focus had been centered on her daughter. Something important. Something terrible. The Reverend Mothers had not told her everything, and now even the sisters in other memory were afraid. The room smelled damp from the rain outside. The old plaster walls were wet and powdery. Though precise heaters kept her private chamber at a comfortable temperature, the homiest warmth came from the embers in the low fire opposite her bed. An inefficient anachronism, but the aroma of wood smoke and the yellow-orange glow of coals inspired a sort of primal complacency. The fires of destruction, the blaze of an inferno sweeping from planet to planet across the galaxy. Jihad! Jihad!
That was to be the fate of humanity if something went wrong with the Bene Gesserit plans for her daughter. Mohiam sat up in her bed, composed herself mentally, and ran a quick check through the systems of her body. No emergencies. Everything functioning normally. All biochemistry optimal. Had it only been a nightmare? Or something more? More rationalization. She knew she must not make excuses, but she had to heed what the premonition had shown her. Other memory knew the truth. Mohiam remained under close observation by the sisters, possibly even now. A purple light in the corner of her room was attached to a night vision kami, with watchdogs on the other end who reported to Reverend Mother Anirul Sado Tonkin, the young woman who seemed to carry an importance beyond her years. Finally, though, in Mohiam's dream, the secretive other memory voices had hinted at Anirul's place in the project. The nightmare had jarred them loose, shocked the reticent recollections into veiled explanations. Kwisatz Haderach, the shortening of the way, the Bene Gesserit's long-sought-after messiah and super-being. The sisterhood had numerous breeding programs, building upon various characteristics of humanity. Many of them were unimportant. Some even served as diversions or shams. None held such prominence as the Kwisatz Haderach program, though. As an ancient security measure at the beginning of the 100-generation plan, the Reverend Mothers, with knowledge of the scheme, had sworn themselves to silence, even in other memory, vowing to divulge the full details to none but a rare few each generation. Anirul was one such, the Kwisatz mother. She knew everything about the program. That is why even Mother Superior must listen to her. Mohiam herself had been kept in the dark, though the daughter growing in her womb was to be only 3 steps away from the culmination. By now the real genetic plan had been set in stone, the end of thousands of years of tinkering and planning. The future would ride on this new child. Her first daughter, the flawed one, had been a misstep, a mistake. And any mistake could bring about the terrible future she had foreseen. Mohiam's nightmare had shown her what could happen to humanity's destiny if the plan went astray. The premonition had been like a gift, and, difficult as the decision was, she could not fail to act on it. She didn't dare. Does Anirul know my thoughts, too? The terrible act foretold in my dream? A warning? A promise? Or a command? Thoughts, other memory, the multitude of ancient ones within offered their advice, their fears, their warnings. They could no longer keep their knowledge of the Kwisatz Haderach silent, as they had always done before. Mohiam could call to them now, and at their discretion they would come forth, individually or in multitudes. She might ask them for collective guidance, but she didn't want that. They had already revealed enough to awaken her with a scream on her lips. Mistakes must not be allowed to happen. Mohiam had to make her own decision, choose her own path into the future, and determine how best to prevent the hideous, blood-filled fate she had foreseen. Rising from her bed, straightening her night clothes, Mohiam moved ponderously through darkness into the next room, the creche where the babies were kept. Her swollen belly made it more difficult to walk. Mohiam wondered if the sisterhood's watchdogs would stop her. Her own churning thoughts made her pause. Inside the dim, warm nursery, she detected the irregular, imperfect breathing of her first Harkonnen daughter, now 9 months old. And in her womb, the unborn sister kicked and twisted. Was this one driving her forward? Had the baby inside triggered the premonition? The sisterhood needed a perfect daughter, healthy and strong. Flawed offspring were irrelevant. In any other circumstance, the Bene Gesserit could have found a use even for a sickly and crippled child. But Mohiam had seen her vital place in the Kwisatz Haderach program. and seen what would happen if the program went down the wrong path. The dream was bright in her mind, like a hollow schematic. She simply had to follow it, without thinking. Do it. Heavy consumption of melange often offered prescient visions, and Mohiam had no doubt of what she had seen. The vision was clear as Hagal crystal, billions murdered, the Imperium toppled, the Bene Gesserit nearly destroyed, another jihad raging across the galaxy, sweeping away all in its path. All of that would happen if the breeding plan went wrong. What did one unwanted life matter in the face of such epical threats? Her sickly first daughter by the Baron Harkonnen was in the way, a risk. That girl child had the potential to ruin the orderly progression along the genetic ladder. Mohiam had to remove any possibility of that mistake, or she could find the blood of billions on her hands. But my own child? She reminded herself that this was not really her child. It was a product of the Bene Gesserit mating index and the property of every sister who had committed herself, knowingly or unknowingly, to the overall breeding program. She'd borne other offspring in her service to the sisterhood, but only two would carry such a dangerous combination of genes. Two. But there could be only one. Otherwise, the risk was too great. This weak baby would never suit the master plan. The sisterhood had already discarded her. Perhaps someday the child could be raised as a servant or cook at the mother school. But she would never achieve anything of significance. Anirul rarely looked at the disappointing infant anyway, and it received little attention from anyone. I care about you, Mohiam thought. Then chastised herself for the emotion. Difficult decisions had to be made. Prices had to be paid. In a cold wave, memories of the nightmare vision washed over her again, strengthening her resolve. Standing over the child in the nursery, she gently massaged its neck and temple, then drew back. The Bene Gesserit did not feel or show love. Not romantic love, not familial love. Emotions were considered dangerous and unseemly. Once again blaming the chemical changes in her pregnant body, Mohiam tried to make sense of her feelings, to reconcile them with what she had been taught all her life. If she didn't love the child, because love was forbidden, then why not? She swallowed hard, unable to form the horrible thought into words. And if she did love this baby, against all dictates, then that was even more reason to do what she was about to do. Eliminate the temptation. Was she feeling love for the child or just pity? She didn't want to share these thoughts with any of her sisters. She felt shame for experiencing them, but not for what she was about to do. Move quickly. Get it over with. The future demanded that Mohiam do this. If she did not act on the prescient warning, whole planets would die. This new child would be a daughter with an immense destiny. And to ensure that destiny, the other had to be sacrificed. But still Mohiam hesitated, as if a great maternal weight restrained her, trying to hold back whatever vision had driven her. She stroked the child's throat, skin warm, breathing slow and regular. In the shadows, Mohiam couldn't see the misshapen facial bones and sloping shoulder. The skin was pale. The baby seemed so weak. She stirred and whimpered. Mohiam felt her daughter's breath hot against her hand. Clenching her fist, the Reverend Mother worked hard to control herself and whispered, "I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer." But she was shaking. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw another Kamai, glowing purple to pierce the darkness of the nursery room. She positioned her body between the Kamai and the child, with her back to the watchers. She looked into the future, not at what she was doing. Even a reverend mother sometimes had a conscience. Mohiam did what the dream had commanded her to do, holding a small pillow over the child's face until sound and movement stopped. Finished, still shaking, she arranged the bedding around the little body, then positioned the dead child's head on the pillow and covered her tiny arms and deformed shoulder with a blanket. Suddenly she felt very, very old, ancient beyond her years. "It is done." Mohiam rested the palm of her right hand on her swollen belly. "Now you must not fail us, daughter." One who rules assumes irrevocable responsibility for the ruled. You are a husbandman. This demands, at times, a selfless act of love which may be amusing only to those you rule. Duke Paulus Atreides. In the Plaza de Toros, up in the spectacular box seats reserved for House Atreides, Leto chose a green cushioned chair beside Romber and Kylea. The Lady Helena Atreides, who had no fondness for such public displays, was late arriving. For the occasion, Kylea Vernius wore silks and ribbons, colorful veils, and a lush, flowing gown that Atreides' seamstresses had made specially for her. Leto thought she was breathtaking. The gloomy skies did not threaten rain, but the temperature remained cool and the air damp. Even from up here he could smell the dust and old blood in the bullring, the packed bodies of the populace, the stone of the pillars and benches. In a grand pronouncement carried by the news crier network all over Caladan, Duke Paulus Atreides had dedicated this bullfight to the exiled children of House Vernius. He would fight in their honor, symbolizing their struggle against the illegal takeover of Ix and the blood price that had been placed on their parents, Earl Dominic and Lady Shando. Beside Leto, Romber leaned forward eagerly, his square chin on his hands as he gazed down at the packed sand of the bullring. His blonde hair had been combed and cut, but somehow it still looked must. With tremendous anticipation and some concern for the safety of the old duke, they waited for the paseo, the introductory parade that would precede the fight itself. Colorful banners hung in the humid air, along with Atreides' hawk pennants over the royal box. In this case, however, the leader of House Atreides was not in his prime seat. He was out in the arena, as performer rather than spectator. All around them, the Plaza de Toros was filled with the humming, chattering sounds of thousands of spectators. People waved and cheered. A local band played balisets, bone flutes, and brassy wind instruments, energetic music that heightened the mood of excitement. Leto looked around the guarded stands, listening to the music and the happy noises of the crowd. He wondered what could be taking his mother so long. Soon people would notice her absence. Finally, with a flurry of female attendants, the Lady Helena arrived, moving through the throng. She walked smoothly, head held high, though her face carried shadows. The ladies-in-waiting left her at the doorway to the ducal box and returned to their assigned seats in the lower level. Without speaking a word to her son or even looking at his guests, Helena settled herself in the tall carved chair beside the empty post where the duke sat on those occasions when he watched the matadors. She had gone to the chapel an hour beforehand to commune with her god. Traditionally, the matador was supposed to spend time in religious contemplation before his fight, but Duke Paulus was more concerned with testing his equipment and exercising. "I had to pray for your father to be saved from his stupidity," she murmured, looking at Leto. "I had to pray for all of us. Someone has to." Smiling tentatively at his mother, Leto said, "I'm sure he appreciates it." She shook her head, sighed, and looked down into the arena as a loud fanfare of trumpets played. sounds that blasted and overlapped in resonating echoes from speakers encircling the Plaza de Toros. Stable boys jogged around the ring in unaccustomed finery, waving bright flags and pennants as they rushed across the packed sand. Moments later, in a grand entrance that he performed so exquisitely, Duke Paulus Atreides rode out, sitting high on a groomed white stallion. Green plumes rose from the animal's headdress, while ribbons trailed from the horse's mane to flow back around the rider's arms and hands. Today the Duke wore a dashing black and magenta costume with sequins, a brilliant emerald sash, and a matador's traditional hat, marked with tiny Atreides crests to indicate the number of bulls he had killed. Ballooning sleeves and pantaloons concealed the apparatus of his protective body shield. A brilliant purple cape draped over his shoulders. Leto scanned the figures below, trying to pick out the face of the stable boy Duncan Idaho, who had so boldly positioned himself working for the Duke. He should have been part of the paseo, but Leto didn't see him. The white stallion snorted and cantered around in a circle as Paulus raised his gloved hand to greet his subjects. Then he stopped in front of the ducal box and bowed deeply to his wife, who sat rigid in her chair. As expected, she waved a blood-red flower and blew him a kiss. The people shouted and cheered as they imagined fairy tales of romance between their duke and his lady. Romber hunched forward on his plush but uncomfortable seat, smiling at Leto. "I've never seen anything like this. I can't wait." Inside the stables, behind force field bars, the chosen Seleucid bull issued a muffled bellow and charged against the wall. Wood splintered. The reinforced iron supports screeched. Duncan scrambled backward, terrified. The creature's multifaceted eyes burned a coppery red, as if embers inside the orbs had glowed to life. The bull seemed angry and evil, a child's nightmare come true. For the paseo, the boy wore special white and green myrrh silks the Duke had given all the stable boys for the day's performance. Duncan had never before worn or even touched such fancy clothes, and it made him uncomfortable to bring them into the dirty stables. But he had a greater sense of uneasiness now. The fabric felt slick on his clean and lotioned skin. Attendants had scrubbed him, trimmed his hair, cleaned his fingernails. His body felt raw from the cleansing. White lace rode at the wrists above his calloused hands. Working in the stables, his pristine condition would not last long. Safe enough from the bull now, Duncan straightened the cap on his head. He watched the beast as it snorted, pawed the plank floor, and rammed the side of the cage again. Duncan shook his head in dismay and concern. Turning, he spotted Iresk standing close beside him. The stablemaster nodded coolly at the ferocious Seleucid bull, his puffy eyes haunted and tired. "Looks like he's eager to fight our Duke." "Something's still wrong, sir," Duncan insisted. "I've never seen the animal this riled." Iresk raised his bushy eyebrows and scratched his shock of white hair. "Oh, in all your years of experience? I told you not to trouble yourself." Duncan bridled at the sarcasm. "Can't you see it yourself, sir?"